This is the morning brief from the Economic Times.
About a week ago, Prime Minister Narendra Modi met with the leaders of political parties from Kashmir.
I mean, how do we take this meeting? Do we take it in a completely sort of negative light, or we take it with some mixed sort of sense that, you know, it could lead to something better?
It seems to me, first of all, that this meeting does not represent a thaw. It represents a trap.
One of the leaders told me that right from when they entered the hall where the meeting was supposed to happen, the first thing that happened was that the Prime Minister greeted them and immediately asked for a photograph.
On the international front, there has been constant questioning of India's actions in Jammu and Kashmir after August 2019. So I think the government attempt to show that they are moving forward on Kashmir could also help stave off, you know, some of the international criticism that is coming in.
This was the first formal engagement between the centre and Kashmiri leaders in nearly 2 years since the Modi government scrapped Article 370 of the Indian Constitution. Not only did Jammu and Kashmir lose its special status with this move, the state was also divided into three union territories. What followed were several restrictions, for example, on movement and internet, that lasted months. Now, this meeting was hoped to be a step towards the restoration of normalcy in the valley. But only 3 days after the meeting, two drones laden with explosives attacked an Indian Air Force station in Jammu, injuring two personnel. While there seems to be a thaw between the central government and Kashmir, how long will this last, and will the recent violence affect this process in any way? I'm Anjali Venugopalan, and you're listening to The Morning Brief. To help us understand what's the way forward for the valley, we have with us former Army Commander, Northern Command, D.S. Huda. Also with us is policy analyst and former Director General of the Delhi Policy Group, Radha Kumar. She was one of the government-appointed interlocutors in Jammu and Kashmir in 2010 and 11. And joining us from Srinagar is ET's political correspondent, Hakim Irfan Rashid. Welcome to the podcast. General Huda, before we go to what happened in the meeting, why did the center make a move like this right now? The Modi government has a reputation of not making any U-turns on its controversial moves, be it demonetization or the farm laws. Were there any geopolitical or domestic compulsions that forced such a move?
So, Anjali, I think there were both domestic and geopolitical considerations. The political process in Jammu and Kashmir had to be restarted. And the attempt by the government to forge a new political dispensation in Kashmir outside of the two main parties, National Conference and PDP, the alternative political front had not really succeeded. We saw that in the DDC elections where the People's Alliance won actually a majority of the seats. So I think therefore, the government understood that they had to involve all regional parties in moving the political process forward. You also had this political vacuum and uncertainty that was actually adding to the process of alienation among sections of society in Kashmir. And if you have a vacuum, I mean, who's going to fill it? So most probably the separatist sentiment is going to fill it. On the international front, there has been constant questioning of India's actions in Jammu and Kashmir after August 2019. Not so much on why the constitutional provisions were changed, but primarily on the issue of human rights, internet shutdowns, detentions that have taken place, etc.
And that shutdown, it's now 134th day on Monday. It's several days more than that. It's now the longest ever imposed in a democracy. There have been authoritarian regimes such as China and Myanmar that have cut off the internet for longer, but India is a democracy. This is not the only internet shutoff they've done, but this is now record-breaking for this form of government.
So I think the government attempt to show that they're moving forward on Kashmir could also help stave off, some of the international criticism that is coming in. And finally, on Pakistan, there have been some encouraging steps in the form of we have a ceasefire agreement that is holding.
India and Pakistan have issued a joint statement, their first in more than 8 years. Some say this has rekindled hope for a peaceful future at the border. But can Pakistan be trusted to keep a promise?
Pakistan has on a number of occasions said that we are waiting for the first step to be taken by India on Kashmir. The Prime Minister Imran Khan has talked about, you know, a roadmap for Kashmir that could sort of help trigger some more rapprochement, some more confidence-building measures.
Irfan, you've been reporting on-ground developments from Srinagar for ET. So tell us what the agenda was for this meeting called between PM Modi, Home Minister Amit Shah and the Kashmiri leaders, and what has been achieved through the meeting so far?
Everybody said was there was no agenda for the meeting. Nobody was conveyed by Delhi that what is the agenda. So it was open-ended in that way. And some leaders termed it as an opportunity because anything and everything could be discussed in the meeting, while as some leaders said that this speaks about the sincerity of Delhi, that they are not bothered, they are just succumbing to international pressure, which is to resume some sort of democratic process or a political process in Kashmir. But we have to understand that after 2 years of sort of hiatus, this all the political parties, whosoever were invited, no one of them showed any reluctance to attend the meeting with no agenda. So one of the leaders told me that right from when they entered the hall where the meeting was supposed to happen, the first thing that happened was that the Prime Minister greeted them and immediately asked for a photograph. So one of the leaders told me that it was very cautious on behalf of Delhi because they thought that if something bad will happen in the meeting or there will be some kind of heated argument or something, maybe they were expecting that. But the point is they wanted to have a photograph so that they can show to the world that this meeting happened and all the leaders who participate in the elections in J&K, they are here and we are talking to them. And after the meeting, the interesting thing is that none of them spoke as a group. All of them put forth their individual point of view. And when we asked Dr. Farooq Abdullah, who is the chairman of the People's Alliance for Gupkar Declaration, which was made in 2020 to strive for the restoration of special status and statehood of J&K, he also said that we had gone as individuals. We expressed our individual views. So essentially, when we say what came out of the meeting, as of now, nothing. The point is that every one of them have put forth their point of view. And one of the leaders from Kashmir, Altaf Bukhari, he said that all these leaders were dissemblers. They said something else in the meeting and they said something else in the media. So as of now, we have just individual responses out of the meeting. The only consequential thing and the practical thing that has happened is that the delimitation commission, which was boycotted by the National Conference Lok Sabha members, now they have called for the meetings with the public representatives from July 6 to July 9. So that will be the first practical follow-up of the meeting with the Prime Minister. So we have to wait, will they participate or not? But they have showed some kind of inclination as of now.
You know, Radha, I want to go back to what has happened earlier. I mean, the BJP government and Kashmir's leaders have had a rather checkered relationship in the past. I mean, the BJP had pulled out of the Mehbooba Mufti government in June 2018, and that led to the governor's rule there. And the decision to scrap Article 370 was also a unilateral one by the center. And since then, several leaders like Mufti and Farooq Abdullah and his son Omar Abdullah of the National Conference have been jailed and for months. So given this hardline stance of the Modi government in the past, how likely do you think this thaw in relations is going to last? And, you know, can we expect something lasting to come out of this?
It seems to me, first of all, that this meeting does not represent a thaw. It represents a trap. The PAGGD leadership and some of the other parties have basically been given an ultimatum. We, the government of India, are going to go ahead with delimitation under the Reorganization Act. And after that, we shall hold assembly elections to this union territory, and statehood will be discussed only later. Now, many of the parties, and I should say groups such as the one that I belong to, are in court challenging both the reading down of Article 370 and the Reorganization Act. Members of the NC are in court. Members actually of the People's Conference are in court. And I'm not quite sure whether the PDP has lately put in a petition of their own or not. But the fact is that there are a large number of petitions challenging the actions of August 2019 before the court, and these have not been heard. So in effect, what the government is asking these people to do is both drop their opposition, more or less undermine the court challenges, accept union territory status, accept the reading down of Article 370. And let me point out that these are all the issues that the government first preemptively arrested them on and put them in detention in order to pass the reading down and the reorganization act.
उस दिन से अनुच्छेद 370 के सभी खंड लागू नहीं होंगे सिवाय खंड 1 के नामक मुस्तदनुसार पढ़ा जाएगा संविधान के समय समय पर.
So the idea that this can be a saw of any sort appears to me to be quite misplaced. The problem really is going to be how now do the PAGD people climb out of this trap? If they participate, they lose whatever credibility they had, and there's not that much left of it. If they don't participate, then they leave the field open for BJP and BJP allies to win the elections. It's it's a very ugly set of choices that have been presented to them. And I would have thought that actually statehood, restoration of statehood, should be relatively easy in the sense that this promise was made anyway. It was made right at the beginning and kept on being made that this union territory status is only temporary and statehood will be restored.
मैंने इसी सदन में कहा है और फिर से कहता हूं कि इस बिल का जम्मू कश्मीर के स्टेटहुड से कोई लेन देन नहीं है. उपयुक्त समय पर जम्मू कश्मीर को स्टेटहुड दिया जाएगा.
In that case, why not do it first? Why not give some opportunity to those people whom you wrongly imprisoned to participate in such a way that at least some semblance or beginnings of peace can be restored in the valley.
All right. So, Radha, according to you, Kashmiri leaders are faced with a tough choice. And now, Irfan, what's your sense of how Kashmiris look at this development?
So, Radha, ma'am, when she talked about these, it's more of a trap. You know what people on the ground in Kashmir think about this engagement? They are not really even bothered to an extent that because they see that those political parties who we in quote unquote in Kashmir call pro-India political parties or pro-election political parties, they have a history of this. Like we see that in 1953 when Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah, the father of Dr. Farooq Abdullah, when he was detained and arrested and kept in jail and all, when he came out, he made a compromise. And then he was made the chief minister of the state. Otherwise, he was the prime minister of the erstwhile state. So same is the case with what happened in 1996 when Farooq Abdullah himself said that Narasimha Rao promised him autonomy and said, sky is the limit, minus independence, we can discuss anything. They went, he said that, what do you say about the promise now? So even now, we have seen this, that this is how Delhi has dealt with these political parties. Because essentially, these are the political parties who believe in the idea of India, who believe in the constitution. So essentially, it's not the real opposition we are talking about. It's the problem within the house. So the other opposition, when we say, would be, in this case, would be, for example, Hurriyat, who are in jail or who have been jailed or who have not been invited for any talks. So this is a problem happening within the house. And then when these political parties and a senior leader actually told me an interesting couplet from Urdu. He said that these political parties, what they have tried to do is ghar ko bacha liya hai daro diwar bech kar. So they are trying to save the house by selling everything that's in the house.
I agree. You know, what Irfan is saying about the situation on the ground and how the people are sort of suffering. My own is, yes, the government has made a move. Yes, the political parties who went are to a certain extent discredited on ground. But can this lead to part of some kind of process in Kashmir? And I think that's the question we have to ask. I mean, would it have been better if the parties had sort of boycotted and not gone there at all, or said that, you know, we will only come if some specific agendas to be discussed? So these are issues really I don't have any answers to. But I mean, how do we take this meeting? Do we take it in a completely sort of negative light, or do we take it with some mixed sort of sense that, you know, it could lead to something better?
The sense I got was that there are some who believe that this is a step in the right direction, even though there are limits to what can be achieved. But yet others say that this is nothing but realpolitik. I asked Irfan what he thought about what is happening to ordinary Kashmiris, and the picture he painted was rather grim. Not only has the region suffered through prolonged internet shutdown, hundreds of political leaders were jailed and FIRs have been filed against journalists as well. And the resulting economic loss has been massive.
Over 7,500 people were detained. There was a report by the Kashmir Chamber of Commerce and Industries that in first year, we suffered a loss of 50,000 crores in Kashmir because of the communication blockade and because of the internet shutdown. I tell you, last week, a couple of journalists were summoned to police stations just for their tweets. And the tweets were not wrong. They had just reported what has happened in their vicinity about some incident. And they were called that, why have you tweeted about this incident? And you are trying to show the us in the bad light. And as far as common people are concerned, you have seen that they are suffering because of the lockdowns. And they are also suffering because they're not able to speak their heart out. You'll see that there is a common thing in Kashmir here these days is baki aapko to pata hi hai. If you go to somebody and tell him kya ho raha hai, so the answer will be aapko to pata hi hai, you don't need to ask me what's happening, because there is a kind of fear and scare that we might have to face the consequences.
You know, moving on to what happened recently, I mean, we had a drone attack on the Indian Air Force installation, Indian Air Force station in Jammu. I mean, the first of its kind, perhaps. And there was also the killing of a local police officer and his family by terrorists. I mean, how do you view the timing of these incidents? And how do you think India is going to respond? And what sort of impact do you think this would have on the process?
So, Anjali, you know, what was the why at this time? What exactly was the trigger? I think it's difficult to say, you know, at this stage. It could well be, you know, a normal part of the cat and mouse game that goes on between the terrorists and the security forces, that the terrorists will always try and, you know, develop new tactics to overcome the security forces. And frankly, you know, drones are not some high-tech equipment. People can actually make most of the parts through a 3D printer, even in their own homes. So if it is, you know, just a part of this, it has a different implication. If we get to know later after investigation that it was either directly controlled or has come from across the border from Pakistan, then it could be an attempt to sabotage the peace process, both in Jammu and Kashmir, and the ceasefire agreement that is currently in place. And so this has a larger implication. Therefore, you know, I would be one who would say, let's wait for the investigation and see exactly why it came about. I'm afraid if there is also an increase in violence, then it could also become a reason to delay the statehood. So if you recall the Home Minister's statement, he has mentioned that, you know, restoration of statehood to Jammu and Kashmir will come about when there is normalcy. So I just hope it doesn't become an excuse if violence escalates to say, look, things are not normal and therefore, you know, we can't grant statehood at this time. That would be, you know, that would be tragic.
Right. I mean, General Huda, you've raised an important point about statehood, and, you know, Home Minister Amit Shah has also said that, you know, statehood would come in at an appropriate time. So, and as of now, we are only talking about delimitation. So my question to you, Radha, is that, you know, what does the central government hope to achieve through delimitation? And why has the center put off the restoration of statehood?
Now, if you look at the kinds of arguments that are being advanced by PAGD and other mainstream political leaders, they all seem to me to be eminently sensible. The rest of the country is going to consider delimitation in 2026. Why should Jammu and Kashmir not be part of a process that the rest of the country is going to undergo? Why is it that you want to do this now? What is the big hurry? Especially when somehow under the Reorganization Act, the government has decided to add 7 seats. What is the logic of 7 seats? Should it be 10 seats? Should it be 20 seats? Should it be 25 seats? Should it be no seats? There is no given in the public domain information, argument, figures. The biggest problem with this delimitation is that they are supposed to go on the basis of the 2011 census, when the 21 census is soon to be performed. So what is the hurry, I ask? The hurry to me seems to be only really petty hubris, rubbing everybody's nose in the ground, saying, accept everything we have done. You have no right to even raise the issues that stem from the decisions made in 2019. I mean, you know, I do have one obsessive question to ask. The Election Commission is an independent body. The Reorganization Act is still under challenge in the Supreme Court. The hearings have not even been completed. They're nowhere near. Only one petitioner has been heard so far. All of these things are being challenged in court. Why are you going ahead with delimitation when that whole issue of the Reorganization Act is under challenge? I mean, I know that the Delimitation Commission has been asked to take into consideration other factors than population, so in addition to population. However, I'm not sure whether that's constitutionally tenable either. If the rest of the country is going on population, how can you say that here it won't? I'm not privy to what this delimitation group is going to do, but I presume they have to ask themselves that question as well, that why an exception, why a difference, what is this? On the one hand, you say that you have gone ahead to integrate it into the country, integrate the former state into the country. On the other hand, you are doing everything to make the people, especially of the Kashmir Valley, believe that they have been singled out for, forget second rate, third rate, fourth rate, no citizenship. I mean, what are their rights? I'd like to know.
Right, right. I think rather a bleak picture that is coming out from what I understand from you, Radha. Going back to this question of violence, I think everybody wants peace in the valley. So, General Huda, my question to you is, I mean, reports seem to indicate that violence in the valley has reduced. What is your sense of the situation going forward? Do you think this is likely to last, or is this reduction in violence simply because of the severe restrictions in place, and I mean the army presence that has only been strengthened perhaps in the last couple of years?
So Anjali, I think one mistake that we make is we equate lack of violence with normalcy, and that's actually not true. Unfortunately, our way of assessing the situation in Kashmir is hugely security-centric. So you look at violence levels, terrorists killed, and then, based on those parameters, we say, oh, look, Kashmir is, returning to normal. So I think we need to look at metrics which are beyond violence levels, which are beyond terrorists killed, etc. And then we will get a good indicator of, for example, levels of alienation, levels of radicalization, the dissatisfaction among various sections of the people. Unless we look at all these metrics and say we will, bring them into our analysis of how the security situation is moving towards normalcy, I think we'll be making a mistake. And therefore, I just come back to that point that I had made, that violence has gone down, and therefore we are moving towards normalcy, I think is not a good way to assess. So I think as everybody is brought out and, Irfan is there on ground and he's explained the situation to you, I think what we need to do is, apart from obviously, the political process restarting, is an outreach towards the people, take a human needs kind of an approach, and see how we can bring in normalcy into people's lives. And not say, we have killed 150 terrorists and therefore, we are winning. We should not make that mistake.
Right. Okay. A very important point that you made there, General Huda. And in fact, I mean, I want to connect that to the next question I have for Radha, which is that, we had lasting peace for quite some time, like you mentioned earlier. So, I mean, how different was it during the Vajpayee dispensation or, during the Manmohan Singh government? And, what sort of lessons do you think we can take from there? Or what sort of, differences do you see between then and now?
Well, both Vajpayee and Manmohan Singh had a fairly comprehensive peace process approach. They had an approach which combined talks with Pakistan and talks with dissident groups such as the Hurriyat. Vajpayee went, of course, even a step further. He initiated negotiations with armed groups for a mutual ceasefire. Unfortunately, Pakistan, to the extent of our knowledge, would not allow that particular track to take off. Now, today, what do we see? We see that forget talking to dissidents, even those who were very much part of the state building project and the national project of India, have been somehow turned into dissidents, pro-Pakistan, in the pocket of this, in the pocket of that, these kinds of allegations. So you can say the goalposts have been shifted a very, very, very long way. Secondly, of course, the Vajpayee and the Manmohan Singh government tried to ensure free and fair elections. It's also in this period that efforts were made to try to improve the human rights and civil liberties. You know that the army had a hearts and minds approach. The state government was empowered to take far wider range of steps in whether it was human rights, whether it was policing, whether it was offering opinions on how to make the peace process or talks with the Hurriyat more productive or make talks with Pakistan more productive. You had cross-border trade. You started limited cross-border travel. There were a whole slew of CBMs, come multi-track dialogue, come political and human rights reforms within Jammu and Kashmir. Even though I take General Huda's point that figures of violence should not be taken as a yardstick, nevertheless, it's noticeable how the trend of declining violence continued right up to 2013, actually. And so that was very important. Now, why were none of those lessons taken on board? That again is a question to be asked of the Modi administration and the government at large. Unfortunately, I can only say that it appears to me that if you look at their manifestos and you look at the policy pronouncements that they were making, then the BJP that came to power in 2014 was very, very, very different from the BJP of the Vajpayee period.
Right. So from what I understand, I mean, there's a lot that can be done, actually bring about the sense of normalcy as the previous governments have shown.
Thank you so much, Radha, General Huda, and Irfan for joining us for this podcast. There are doubts about what exactly the meeting between the center and Kashmiri leaders will result in. But what's clear is that there is a massive trust deficit between the Modi government, Kashmir's leaders, and Kashmiri people. And the past has shown us that it is not impossible to bridge this gap, even if it sometimes takes months and years to do so and bring peace to the valley. While small signs of spring seems to have emerged in the valley, it remains a fragile one for now. This episode was edited and coordinated by Nehal Chaliawala. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode. Do share your feedback with us on themorningbrief@timesgroup.com and share the episode on your social media handles. The Morning Brief airs every Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Thank you for listening and have a great day.